And we'd like to welcome everybody to the Football's Family Podcast, recording on a Saturday morning because my guest and I have played musical schedules. We both cannot find a date that would work for us, but we finally did at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, Craig Colquitt, former player at the University of Tennessee, who's very proud of the Tennessee basketball Vols right now. First time for Barnes to be in the Elite Eight and second time for Tennessee. So history is made last night. From Knoxville, Tennessee, raised two boys and have nine grandkids. My two sons played in the NFL. I played with the Steelers 78 through 84. First 2 years, won Super Bowl. So I was spoiled. And, pretty exciting and blessed career, and now live in Lebanon, Tennessee, about to move back to East Tennessee.
Yeah, he is. He pointed to his hat. We're not going to, this is all audio because.
Oh, okay. I got
no, it's okay. It's all audio because I don't know how to transfer it over yet. I haven't figured that out.
That's good. I can keep drinking coffee.
Well, you're good. You're good. But he pointed to his UT Knoxville hat. Last night, Mr. Craig, I was leaving the movie theater. I watched Godzilla yesterday. I had to do it. And I walked by a place that had the game playing, and I noticed the score. It was just started. So what did the score last night end up being for the
– 80 – was it 82 or 80-67?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we had an 18-point run at one point. Everything just kind of started gelling. We were really off in the beginning. I mean, we weren't hitting anything, and then it just kind of transitioned. But Barnes really shut Creighton down with the defense. They couldn't function properly.
You know, the one thing, and this is not what we're going to talk about today, but I love different topics coming up. The one thing that I enjoy about March Madness is – the different schools that you never hear about can excel in basketball. I don't think Creighton has a football team, but they made it to the Sweet 16. And you know what's funny? This is NAIA, which the school I attended was NAIA. They won my alma mater won their national championship a couple days ago. So,
who's that?
Freed Hardeman University.
Freed Hardeman, I've heard of that. Where is that?
That is over in Henderson, Tennessee, just where I am, just about an hour west of here. Where you are is about two and a half or so.
I knew I'd heard of it. I used to travel the entire state of Tennessee in the business I was in. So
you probably know where that is. But yeah. I thought that was pretty cool that you don't really hear about a lot of schools like Creighton. Pepperdine was big. And then you had, anyway, this is about you. This is – but he is wearing his UT Knoxville hat. So let me ask you a question. So you played for a number of years for Pittsburgh, and you were a graduate of Freed Hardeman. That's me. You're a graduate of UT Knoxville. What got you into football in general and punting specifically?
My sophomore year in high school, the head coach asked everybody on the team who wanted to try out for punter because our current punter was going to be a senior. Entire team tried out. And I just happened to be the backup place kicker. Hadn't even tried punting. And it came whittled it down to me and one other guy. And I got the job because as the words of the head coach, he said, he's taking two steps. He's faster. We won't get a punt blocked. So essentially my career was born then. I was a hurdler in junior high school and actually won the city in hurdles. And I was always on the track stretching and preparing for that. So I think that stretching and that discipline of running the hurdles just taught me a lot about individualism and being on my own. But the transition was essentially a tryout, and the head coach pointed it out.
So the kicking and punting, we really give the special teams a lot of hate but it's necessary. The kicking motion and the punting motion are two different things. It seems to me, at least, and I'm ignorant on that. Is it two different things?
Well, I was a square toe front. About the shoe I was using was a square toe, so I was kicking like Dempsey did.
Oh yeah, yeah.
A long time ago, so that it was the same motion, except the toe was up. But it was an easy transition to punting because eventually, I'd run off the field, put on the kicking shoe for kickoffs, and take it back off because I was running it back in defensive end. I literally never left the field in high school football except during field goals.
It just amazes me, and your sons did it too. And I remember I told you I played as – I've had your sons on my Madden team before, which I thought was pretty cool. It's amazing to me that people want to be punters, because if you make one mistake, and I remember the Miracle of the Meadowlands 2, or getting a punt blocked, that is one of the most dangerous positions to be in, just with your leg extended and all that. But tell me, were you recruited as a punter, or were you recruited as something else?
At Tennessee?
Yes.
I walked on when I was 20 years of age. I graduated from high school and essentially just went to work, trying to figure out what I was going to do in life. And an article was in the Knoxville News, Knoxville Journal, advertising for anyone reading this article that has punted, wants to try out as punter at the University of Tennessee, is welcome to try out. Send your information. And I answered the letter, and Coach Cafigo, George Cafigo, is my coach. And he responded back, he said, I've never worked with two-step punters. And if you hit a 74 punt in college, that'll work in college. Cause I'd hit a 74-yard punt in high school, no return. So from there, he invited me over, and I was really from scratch. Occasionally I'd hit a monster and then shank for it. But through his development, that's how it all came about. That year, Neil Clabo was the punter at the University of Tennessee, and it was his senior year, so I didn't play my freshman year. And Neil went on to play for the Minnesota Vikings, drafted, I'm not sure what round, or even if he's free agent, I have to look that up. But played 3 years for Tennessee, made all SEC twice, and never had a punt blocked. And Steelers drafted me third round in 78 over the Dallas Cowboys, who said they were going to take me in the fifth because I wanted to be a Cowboy, actually. But Pittsburgh took me in the third, and worked out pretty good because we beat Dallas every time we played them.
I was one of the things I enjoy, Mr. Craig, is football history. And Dallas won, I think, two Super Bowls before all this, and then of course three in the 90s. But if it wasn't for your Steelers, can you imagine just how devastating the Cowboys would have been there in the 70s? How much they would have just ran rampant on the NFL?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's a reflection, I think, of before free agency. Teams were built, and there was a camaraderie and a team spirit that comes from that. And you're right, the Steelers were a reflection of that too. That whole team was basically together when I got there as well. So you're right. That's how that kind of dynasties are built before free agency.
There was a question on Facebook that I answered, that what was the turning point for the Steelers? And, the Steelers have been around since the 30s. I want to say 33, maybe. I'm not certain exactly. I might be off on that. But I mentioned that the turning point to me was the 69 draft. And if I remember correctly, Joe Green was the first pick of that draft, because Chuck Knoll was given control over it. And it's at that point that you started to see those pieces kind of fall into place that you, of course, you played it and you did great too, but you benefited from, like you said, years of development. And you were put in a position where very few people, Brian Griese was one of them, their rookie year, could win a Super Bowl.
Yeah, I'd like to see what that, the odds of that are. I hadn't delved into that, but yeah, Joe Green was 69. I think Bradshaw's probably 72. And then the big transition, Franco's probably 72 as well, or 73. Maybe 73. And then, but 74 is the big draft, which was, you know, Donnie Shell, I think, was a free agent, Jack Lambert.
Yeah.
Third round or second round or something. But, you know, that's John Stallworth, Lynn Swann. Just the pieces. I don't know where L.C. Greenwood fit in there. But, yeah, just from the draft, you know, they built into that instead of having free agency, tried to buy a team. You know, that's I think strategically that it was more difficult, or I think in my mind more difficult to keep people healthy and build it as a dynasty over years than it would be free agency.
You are your team in particular, the Steelers. You played the Steelers your entire career, correct?
I tried attempted Atlanta Falcons in Baltimore. Indianapolis Colts, but didn't work out.
Okay, but let's stick with the Steelers for a little bit then.
Yeah, that's a better conversation.
we'll do that then. Your team, number one, I think you told us stories about pretty decent ownership. Pretty decent, the Rooneys.
Right, absolutely.
One thing I enjoy about listening, of course, I don't know the stories, and of course you do, you experience them firsthand, is how they kept with them in the World War II, with the Cardinals and the Steelers and the Eagles and the Steelers, the Steagles and the Carpets. your organization there, the Rooneys, pretty much kept the NFL going. It was the Rooneys that were willing to negotiate about the AFL, NFL. And it was the Rooneys who, to me, with their ability to get away from the owner, from the coaches, the Steelers have had three coaches in about 50 years. Isn't that insane?
It's a reflection, like you're saying, because you know, it's hands off. You know, the Rooneys were about the bottom line. You know, the outs off the field. You know, let the coaches run the game and. That's the way I felt. You know, the administration was a whole different animal compared to the team.
Now,
and you know, Noel could think on his own feet, and every coach was able to do. Said, "I want to coach," and you all back up.
He did a good job. Like I was telling Mr. Craig that I got a puppy here, and I need to find her. One thing about the Steelers that I really enjoy is, oh, she's right there. She's good. She looked at me and said, "What are you waking me up for?"
Her she's name growing.
She is. Her name is Moneypenny because I'm a James Bond nerd, and I like that one.
I like it.
Yeah, she. We can't put her name on a collar yet because it's too big. So we'll figure something out. Anyway, was it Art Rooney, the primary owner at the very beginning? What I love about it was Art Rooney, correct?
Yep, Art Rooney Sr.
What's that?
Art Rooney Sr. Yes,
Art Rooney Sr. He, I love his background, his stories. I think John Eisenberg had a book about him, a fantastic book. He's a neat guy, but I love watching him getting the Lombardi Trophy with that big old cigar in his mouth and his thick old glasses, and he's just crying because he is so happy, and that's just who he was, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, he was a quick story to tell you how he was. I'm sitting in the locker room on a Saturday morning, practice just ended, and I have Dustin with me, and he's about 2 and a half. And he's running around, and Art Rooney Sr. appeared into the locker room. Evidently, he was out on the field, just walked in there, and the first thing he did was remove his cigar and said, "Who's this?" And I said, "This is Dustin." And he said, "Do you all follow me?" And I'd imitate his Irish Pittsburgh accent, but it was thick. We followed him to his office, and he sat down and Crescenta turned around, and I'm kind of handling Dustin, and he turned, Art Rooney turned back around. He had a baseball in his hand, and he signed it. "Dusty, you'll be a superstar someday, Art Rooney Sr." Still had it. Dustin wanted to play with it, and I managed to keep it away from him for 30 years before I ever presented it to him. So we still have it. But that's who he was, very personal. He and Bradshaw were close as don't have a good analogy, but they were really close friends. So that's who Art Rooney was. Yeah.
Well, of course, we're talking about your story here, but Bradshaw to me, and I think he mentioned it, I think I read something about it. He said he was not the greatest quarterback, but he played in a team that made him better. And the way I understand about the Steelers is obviously you had superstars, Joe Green being one of them, Greenwood being another one. Swan was a superstar, but I think Starworth had better ability to get open. Swan was just insane with what he could do with the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Rocky Blyer, which is a great story as well. And you all had to work together because, again, during this time, there were pretty much two teams running the NFL. Your choice. Growing up in East Tennessee, you probably heard about the Cowboys from the time that they started to do well until the time you were drafted, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, Gil Brandt sent me a letter my senior year every week. So I knew I was going to be a Cowboy. And everybody had a blue star somewhere in their room. But yeah, you know, the Chicago Redskins, Falcons, Cowboys, and occasionally Steelers were always on the TV, the three channels when I was growing up. So, but yeah, the way it turned out to be the Pittsburgh Steelers and the domination with them and the Cowboys is a very interesting story.
Gil Brandt, I have an interesting Gil Brandt story, and I know you probably have several. Of course, I never met the man, but we are, for what I understand, we are better for him to be here, for him to have been here.
Yes, I agree with that.
He was hosting a radio program on NFL, the NFL Sirius Radio. And I called in and I thought, I'm not going to get in. And I got in. And it was him and I can't think of the other guy, but we're here to talk to Gil Brandt because that guy was just a walking encyclopedia. He has forgotten more than most of us will ever know. And I called in and I said, "Well, I'm from Tennessee." And he didn't want my question yet. He said, "Where in Tennessee?" And I said, "Waverly, Tennessee." And he commenced to talk about people who I knew from Waverly, Tennessee, and stories about football. I was like, "Okay, who is this man?" And I was like, he knew that. I imagine that there are places that he never attended or been to, but he still knew something about it. It just amazed me when I started talking to him.
He has been real friendly with Dustin and Britton, even over the years. Always came up and said something to him in the pregame warm-up area. So when they were playing the Cowboys, and then if he's ever down there on the field, so he'd always say the same thing, say, "Hello, your dad." Because, you know, he told me that he's going to draft me in the fifth round, and Pittsburgh took me in the third. So pretty interesting.
There's probably not a football stadium that if Gil Brandt walked up and said, "I want to go down to the field," that they would have told him no.
Big cart block, probably. Big
So you played 78 to 84 for the Steelers. You won two Super Bowls. And I believe when we talked on the big group, you showed me the rings. Which one, and you told me which one, but I've slept since then. Which one do you like the most? Just the way it looks.
Super Bowl 13 is, it's kind of glamorous like a ring should be, even though it's a third the size of Dustin and Britton's Super Bowl rings. Super Bowl 14's smaller, looks more like a class ring. But Super Bowl 13 kind of has that, you know, that jump at you, look at me, look?
So I'm looking at Super Bowl 13, and it was a close. Was this the Jackie? This was the was his name Jackie Slater, or was that the one where he dropped the pass?
Isn't that Smith?
Jackie Smith, you're right. Yes.
Yeah. That was, hit him in the chest.
Jackie Slater played offensive line for the Rams. Yeah, it hit him in the chest. And was that this particular game?
It was that game. Yeah, right then it just, you could hear the air going out of the stadium in big blue.
Because this game was close. It came down to, what, 4 points? Y'all covered the spread. Apparently the spread was 3.5, and y'all covered it. What do you remember about that game?
Well, before the game, when we pulled into the stadium, the parking lot, the bus, we were in buses, the parking lot was completely filled with black and gold. I mean, literally, the bus pushing people out of the way. It was almost like they were going through water. And how dressed up everybody was, painted faces, black and gold. And I knew then just really how big it was. And I was nervous at that time, anxious, but that kind of made everything go cold and numb in my body. But just how the buildup of the game is, and I've said this a thousand times, I anticipated that whole week that God was going to come down during halftime because it was just such a buildup for that game. And maybe that was only in my mind, because the good thing is how calm everybody else seemed, because most of the team already had two rings,
yeah.
You know, and I'm looking at my first ring. So I guess a big question mark on my head was, how was I going to perform in that game? But just the back and forth of that game, every score, you know, Rocky Blyer has a touchdown catch in that game, and Rocky doesn't have more than a 5-inch vertical jump. And I think if you look back at the catch, which I just saw the other day, you know, that he looks like he's got a 3-foot vertical jump. So it's everything's amplified times 1,000 in a Super Bowl for the individual players.
What I love about your particular story about your team and about, it's just the personalities, but Rocky Blyer was not just a personality. He was a doggone hero. Mm-hmm. What he overcame. And again, you know, if you don't know the story, and I remember on the NFL films, I watched this so many times. Vietnam, I believe he was a Steeler, and he either was drafted or he volunteered, very similar to Pat Tillman, if that's the case. He volunteered to be, you know, he was in Vietnam, and a grenade rolled in front of him, and I believe he jumped on it, and he said that it exploded out, not up. And his exact quote is, if it exploded up, I wouldn't be here, but exploded out. And with that type of explosion and that type of percussion or concussion, it could have killed him. And yet here he is playing in a Super Bowl with a 3-foot jump.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote a book, Fighting Back, and it was even made into a movie or a documentary. I can't remember, but yeah, he was. I don't know if he was a free agent or drafted, but by the Steelers. But then I think he was drafted to Vietnam. So Steelers said, your uniform will be here, your helmet will be here when you get done. So I think because of the injury, his time in Vietnam's cut short. So, but everybody said the doctor said he wouldn't walk again, and he'd probably spend his life using a cane. You know, so that's Fighting Back. And hero, showed a stick-to-itiveness that was reflected through his whole career. Undersized, slow guy, and he was amazing. Again,
this is your team. This is the team that you were drafted in, who really – there was a picture, I believe it's on Sports Illustrated, and I know you know it, Willie Stargell and Terry Bradshaw in a steel mill. Around in the background, there was the steel mill. That is Pittsburgh.
Yep.
and you knew, well, maybe, okay, growing up in Knoxville, it is not, we both admit it, but there's not a lot of Tennessee towns other than Franklin that's really glamorous. That's not who we are. That's not who the state of Tennessee is. Franklin is very glamorous. It is very glamorous. It is a very wealthy town. Knoxville, Nashville, Memphis are two, but if you were to look at Franklin compared to the rest, it's a completely different state. Pittsburgh is a blue-collar state, or city, and you were part of that. So it's probably not that big of a culture shock for you, was it?
Actually, it's a big city. The big, transition for me when I first got to Pittsburgh, I was picked up at the airport and taken to Pittsburgh, and you go through the tunnels before you get to Pittsburgh, and then all of a sudden there's the city. And I remember distinctly as we're heading out, bypassing the city, I'm seeing this yellow smoke everywhere, and the steel mills are still in heavy operation at that time. And fast forward, I get to camp, make the team, and I befriended the media pretty quickly because I'm, you know, kind of an open book. And one of the reporters asked me if I heard of KDKA radio. And I said, no, what's that? And he said, well, it's country music. And it's the biggest radio station in Pittsburgh. It probably still is today. But it's country music. And that's what I was listening to back home. And of course, Rolling Stones and everything modern at that time. But I was listening to it all the time. And I ended up being a regular guest on KDKA because I was into the country music. But
then, you're telling me that Pittsburgh, the number one radio station, was country music?
I'm pretty sure that they said it's number one listening to radio station in Pittsburgh at the time because it broadcast the games too.
Okay.
So that's a big part of it. But it was country music the whole week, and it was always on, of course, with Bradshaw. You know, he's country through and through. And that made it a whole lot easier that those guys were who they were, and made it easier for me to move into Pittsburgh because country music.
Ronnie Millsap. I grew up with, every time I'd go to my granny's house on Gardner's Creek in Dixon, she'd have this little radio playing, and it's country music. It would be 95.5 WSM. And I remember songs that, you know, I was trying to place them where they were. And one of the songs I remember, and I started listening to it over and over again, was Ronnie Millsap's Smoky Mountain Rain.
Oh, yeah.
And when you talk about that, that's the first thing that popped up in my head. If you've not listened to Ronnie Millsap's Smoky Mountain Rain, you are depriving yourself of one of the best songs ever made.
I agree with that. Yeah, Millsap was amazing. I was shocked when I first found out, you know, he's blind even, you know, because that's a huge impact. I actually happened to play guitar and write. So developing music is so deep in your mind. I think that's why country music was such an impact on me growing up. I even told the boys, I'm driving down, when they were young, driving down the road, they were probably 12, 13, 14. I said, and I got country music on and they want me to turn it off. And I said, one of these days, boy, you're going to love country music and you're going to like your music too. And they said, there's no way, Dad. Fast forward to college. Then I get to college, everybody's listening to country music. You know, so it's the thing. I actually happen to live where I'm living and moving away from. It's originally was the estate of a guy named Curly Putman. And Curly Putman, with other writers, wrote the George Jones hit, He Stopped Loving Her Today. And he wrote Green, Green Grass of Home and D-I-V-O-R-C-E, Divorce, on this estate. It was 138 acres, and it's been whittled down. I've got 11.6, and there's a guy with 60, a guy with 47 acres. So it's kind of in my blood, especially living here for the past 10 years.
What I like about that particular one, that's Tammy Wynette, Divorce.
Yeah.
She also sang Stand By Your Man. Yeah. Which one came first and which one came second? Maybe she
I
just
think D-I-B-O-R-C is yeah, it probably came after, you know, after you go through divorce. But, you know, it's interesting about the George Jones hit. George Jones did not want to sing that song. He said, it's too depressing. Nobody will want to hear it. And it ended up being the number one country song of all times. You know, so it's the, there's even, you know, I've got a book here, you know, the George, basically why George Jones didn't want to sing that song. And it ends up being a big hit.
Oh, if you, again, if you've never heard that one, he had a distinct sound that if you heard him, you would know immediately that is George Jones. And when he did that, and I'm trying to explain it, he kind of has a nasally sound to him, but again, it's more like a baritone nasally sound that's just beautiful. And mm-hmm. when he goes into the chorus, he stopped loving her today. You're like, all right, George, you won me. I mean, you don't have to do anything else. You don't have to do anything else. That's it.
George Jones sounds like he's already crying. He's a, you know, he's so emotional sounding voice. So he was the perfect selection for that song.
I want to say that the first song that I can remember, of course, I went back, but the first song I remember is I Don't Need No Rocking Chair. And then they had all those country song singers get into it. And then, you know, you can go back and you go on Spotify. I listen to Spotify all the time. You go on there and you can just pull up everything that he's ever done. And you're right. It sounds like he's already, in a lot of them, he's already crying or drunk or one of two.
Probably a combination.
But there's a picture of him riding on his John Deere tractor getting pulled over. It's up at the local restaurant. We live here next to where Loretta Lynn, I'm pointing that direction like you could tell. Loretta Lynn, when she was alive, lived right over there. She was just right across the way from us. And there's a restaurant up here on the interstate called Loretta Lynn's Restaurant. And in it, they had a big picture of George Jones getting pulled over by the cops in his, in his John Deere tractor. See, this is what I'm talking about, Mr. Craig. And again, I told you, we're running out of time here for Zoom. I do appreciate you coming on, my friend. You are definitely not only a blessing to me, but for the rest of the people on our podcast network that you've got a chance to talk to. Your story is encouraging. The fact that you got back into football and then got drafted. The fact that a punter got drafted is incredible. I mean, we're talking like Ray Guy got drafted. We get Ray Guy, but for the most part, punters don't get drafted, and you did, which tells you something about you and your abilities, which is very impressive. And I love it. And the fact that you have instilled into your sons very similar work ethic, so that they could both succeed in their fields and their abilities. And you said both of them were Super Bowl champions.
Both of them. Dustin has written his Super Bowl 50 with Peyton Manning, and Dustin,
yes.
Dustin is Super Bowl champion with Peyton, Patrick Mahomes. So it's interesting. I was Bradshaw, Britton was Peyton Manning, and Britton and Dustin was with Mahomes. And I think somebody, maybe it's hard, somebody pointed that out the other day. I never thought of it that way. I was with Bradshaw, Britton was with Peyton, Dustin's with Mahomes. And that's amazing if you think of it.
That's pretty good company to be with.
It's pretty good company.
Bradshaw could pass, obviously. The Steelers were more of a running team. But Bradshaw can do it because you had two of the best receivers of all time. But you change over to your son's generation. Peyton was a passer. A pretty decent one, if I remember correctly. He was okay.
You know, it's interesting. At University of Tennessee, I remember watching him on TV, and I said, this guy can't throw a spiral. He's so strong. He's throwing ducks, and they're getting there. The ball is getting there. You know, ducks meaning wobbling.
Yeah.
And he gets to the pros, and I think he's I don't know who is working with him at the time. It might have been Tom Moore, who's like 85 years old, still in the NFL. All of a sudden, I'm seeing him throw spirals. And that was a huge transition for Peyton. But
the Colts are glad that they didn't draft Ryan Leaf. That's all I can say about that. 90.
It's amazing. It's amazing how things worked out.
Well, Mr. Craig, my time is about to run out. I do appreciate you coming on. When I stop recording and if it kicks off, it's not personal. It is Zoom kicking me off. Thank you so much for coming on.
Jeremy, I appreciate your time. I'm glad we finally got it together.
Please, if I can ever help you out, please let me know and have a safe trip to Knoxville. And, you know, as much as it kind of pains to say, go Big Orange.
There you go. Appreciate
it. Let's see if they can win a national championship.
Barnes is a good man. So he's a good, the ideal coach for a player.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. And thank y'all for listening to Football's Family Podcast.
Thank you. Take